Welcome to Canary in a Cornfield, a podcast from the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, where we explore how the policies that shape our food and farming systems impact our health, our communities, and our future. As most of our listeners probably know, the Harkin Institute was founded upon the retirement of longtime public servant and Iowa legend Tom Harkin in order to continue doing high-quality work on the policy issues that were important to him. My guest for this episode is Kari Hammerschlag, Deputy Director of Friends of the Earth's Agricultural Program. I've followed her work for a while, which includes both great work in the U.S. and also work dealing with international institutions. What caught my eye most recently is an op-ed that Kari wrote for The Hill, where she discusses something that's being missed in many of the discussions about toxic chemicals in our food, namely the dense amount of toxic contaminants that accumulate in animal tissue, fat, and milk that comes from industrial animal agriculture. In this episode, we discuss the op-ed, Friends of the Earth's extensive environmental portfolio of working on agricultural issues, and we continue our discussion of the recent nutrition guidelines. Kari also gives some great suggestions of what her priorities are in regards to reforming our current agricultural system. So with that, I will jump into the episode. I'm really excited today to be joined by Kari Hammerschlag of Friends of the Earth, someone who I've been following for quite a while and who wrote an op-ed that made a very important point given the moment we're at in history. Kari, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm excited to talk to you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Before we dive in and talk about the op-ed, I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about your own background and how you came into your current position.
So I've been at Friends of the Earth now for 12 years, actually. My 12th year anniversary is coming up in March, and I have been working on food and agriculture in the U.S. context for about 20 years. Before Friends of the Earth, I was with the Environmental Working Group for about 5 years, and before that worked as a consultant for a whole range of organizations, including NRDC and Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, lots of different organizations, including a coalition of California sustainable ag groups. We had a coalition working on the 2006 Farm Bill. So I've been involved in food and agriculture policy for a number of years. And then before that, I worked in Latin America out of DC, but worked on a lot of issues relating to Latin America for about 15 years. But I did get my start as an intern at the Institute for Food and Development Policy in San Francisco, also known as Food First, which is still going today. And that's where I started learning a lot about our food system.
So one of the things I love about Friends of the Earth is how much you guys pay attention to the food system. And the food system is obviously such a hugely important issue for the environment. And I'm sometimes disappointed in some environmental organizations for not spending that much time on it. But Friends of the Earth is excellent. And I'm guessing that has a lot to do with you being there. So thank you for that work. For people who don't know, maybe you could say a little bit more about what Friends of the Earth does, and especially things that connect to food system and agriculture work.
Yeah, and thank you so much for that. I agree. I think that the environmental community has come a bit late to the issue of food and agriculture. And I think more and more groups are paying attention because they're seeing that it's of great concern to lots of people. And I think the connections between the environment, environmental health, and food system are much more apparent now. But yeah, so Friends of the Earth is an environmental and social justice organization. We've been around in the U.S. for about 50 years and have more than 4 million grassroots supporters. We focus on environmental and social justice issues. What you may not know is that we are part of the largest grassroots environmental network globally. We have 70 sister organizations around the world that also work on similar issues with similar perspectives. We are independent, but we do unite into a broader umbrella at Friends of the Earth International, where we work on a whole range of issues together, focused more on international advocacy. I love that we're part of this bigger network of organizations. It keeps us connected to a lot of the work, because we do a lot of international work in our U.S. based group. And then in terms of our food and agriculture works, Friends of the Earth works on a lot of different issues: climate change, clean energy, ocean health, but we also have a very robust food and agriculture program. And actually, we're the largest program at Friends of the Earth right now, which is cool. I think we have about 15, 16 staff maybe working on food and agriculture right now. And our focus in the food and ag program is to transform our food system in the U.S. from toxic, chemical-intensive, corporate-controlled systems that are heavily dependent on pesticides and GMOs, factory farming to more healthy, just ecologically regenerative systems. So we're really trying to shift away from this toxic, chemical intensive food system. And we do that through a whole range of programs that all involve research, policy advocacy, coalition building, where we do a lot to foster coalitions, market shifts, and then strategic communications. That's the overview of what we do. And then I can walk through a few of the programs that we have if you're interested to hear more.
Definitely.
Great. The two programs that I particularly oversee as the deputy director of the program, although I'm involved in all of it, the first one is focused on animal agriculture reform. And in that program, we are working to shift policies and subsidies away from profoundly harmful industrial animal agriculture systems towards more sustainable and humane organic and pasture-based systems. And for the last few years, we've been especially focused on stopping the growing momentum for factory farm gas, which is a real driver for the expansion of factory farms in the U.S. And it's subsidized heavily through policy by the government. I know you've had some podcasts on that issue, and I would encourage everyone to go back and listen to them. So we do a lot of focus on factory farm gas. We also focus our work on, at the policy level, the USDA, the EPA, and Congress, as well as at the state level. We work in a whole range of states with local partners in Maryland, Michigan, Washington State to strengthen policies around environmental enforcement of industrial livestock facilities, and then also trying to shift the funding away from all the subsidies, because there are subsidies at the state level as well. And at the international level, we also have a campaign that I helped start about 5 years ago called the Stop Financing Factory Farming Campaign. And we're the secretariat for this global campaign that is focused on shifting public international funding away from factory farming towards more agroecological farming practices. And that has been very successful. We have over 30 groups internationally involved in this coalition. And we've made quite a bit of, I think, progress at the World Bank and Inter-American Development Bank, where we've been focused on trying to shift the financing away from these industrial livestock companies towards more sustainable farming. That's a great global campaign that we've been involved with. And then we also have a climate-friendly school food program, which is focused on advancing climate-friendly and values-aligned public procurement. So food purchasing by public entities. And we're especially focused on school meals, working to shift school meals away from industrial meat and dairy products, which account for the vast majority of the food there, towards more plant-based, organic, and regeneratively produced animal products. That program is a big bright spot for us. We work with over 100 school districts in California. We've made major, major progress in shifting to more wholesome plant-based food and organic. We've gotten a lot of organic food into the schools, actually utilizing the USDA DoD Fresh program. So not even asking for any policy shifts. We're just using an existing program and getting more organic suppliers into that program to supply the school districts. And then we also have a federally focused plant-based meals coalition that recently just helped to introduce a bill that would establish a pilot program for plant-based food in schools. And that is also a really exciting coalition that has a lot of students involved. So we do a lot of youth organizing and advocacy because it's the kids that are most affected. We try to bring their voice into that as much as possible. And then I'll just mention the third program briefly. And the third program is focused on pollinator protection and pesticides. So in that program, we are working to reduce toxic pesticides and expand organic farming in the U.S. And we have market campaigns that have been really successful, getting companies like Costco and Whole Foods to adopt policies to reduce their use of toxic pesticides. And then we also are working to pass legislation at the state level banning or restricting neonicotinoids, which are highly toxic to bees and other things. And we've been successful in many states doing that. And we've been focused quite a bit on the issue of greenwashing in the regenerative agriculture space, because we believe that pesticide reduction needs to be central to regenerative agriculture. And we see a lot of greenwashing where they're just basically calling no-till agriculture regenerative. And we know it's very heavily glyphosate dependent and using a lot of toxic pesticides and destroying the soil. So we've been focused on that. But we have a lot of research online about pesticides and soil health, and would encourage people to go online to foe.org, to learn more about all of these programs, really. So all the information's on our website.
I would love to talk about every one of those in more detail. We need to have a five-part series just explaining all the things that Friends of the Earth is working on. But Yeah, that's really impressive and such important topics. And the fact that you have the biggest staff working on this issue, it shows in how broad your portfolio is and how many interesting issues you're working on. And we might come back to a couple of those later if we have time. But I did want to ask you about this op-ed in The Hill that you co-wrote that I thought made a really insightful point. And of course, we're at this moment of history where MAHA is very influential. Make America Healthy is very influential in the federal government. And we just had dietary guidelines come out. I think your op-ed was written before they even came out, but it made a really important point. So I was hoping you could walk us through the idea behind that op-ed and what you were trying to communicate.
So before the dietary guidelines came out, we knew that there was a lot of talk. We heard Secretary Kennedy speak often about the war on saturated fat and how it's misguided and how we need more meat. They talked a lot about the need for more meat, full fat dairy. So we were hearing signs that the dietary guidelines would be promoting those things. And I felt that it was important to bring up a topic that is not often discussed about saturated fat in animal products and fat in general. That's been really missing from this discussion, and that is the toxic chemical exposure in animal fats, particularly dioxins, which are among the most dangerous pollutants that are known. Dioxins are persistent industrial chemicals that accumulate in animal fat, and they remain in the environment and in our bodies for many years. And according to the EPA and other bodies, about 90% of the dioxin that we ingest comes directly from animal foods because of the fat in animal foods. And the health implications of dioxins are well documented. They're linked to cancer, hormone disruption, immune system damage, reproductive and developmental harm. They cross the placenta, so they can be passed from mother to child. And then because they accumulate over time, even low-level exposures can add up over a lifetime. And for those who don't know about dioxins, they're byproducts of industrial activity like waste incineration, chemical manufacturing, burning of plastics, and chlorine, other things. And once they're released into the air, the dioxins settle onto the soil and the water, and they contaminate the crops and the animal feed, and then they move up the food chain. So when animals ingest these contaminants through the feed and the soil and the water, because the dioxins dissolve in fat, they build up in the meat, dairy, eggs, and fish. So that's how the dioxins actually end up. And what's so ironic is that MAHA is all about getting toxic chemicals out of our food system. And that's actually a goal that we share with a lot of MAHA organizations and leaders. We are grateful that they have elevated this issue with Republicans, because Republicans are the ones that are fighting for pesticide immunity shields right now. But they really do care a lot about toxic chemicals. And until recently, Secretary Kennedy was one of the leading advocates against pesticide use in our food system. So he was supposed to care about this. I'm highlighting dioxins in particular because it just doesn't get attention, even though it should. But dioxins are only part of the picture. The industrial meat production also exposes consumers to a chemical cocktail that includes antibiotic residues, growth-promoting drugs and hormones like ractopamine, pesticides used in animal feed, and then there's heavy metals as well. And we know that routine antibiotic use in livestock fuels antibiotic resistance. It's a growing public health crisis. And just in the last 3 years, antibiotic use in animals, particularly in swine and beef, has jumped 25%. That's from the FDA's own data, 25%. Wow. So we're seeing an increase in the use of these chemicals. And we know that hormones and other endocrine disrupting chemicals raise big flags, especially for children and adolescents. There are a lot of chemical contaminants in the animal fats, and particularly saturated fat. If we're looking for like the big full fat steak, like that's where they are. And I think we can certainly also talk about the fact that promoting steak at the top of the pyramid to address chronic illness like heart disease is just ridiculous. Who believes that eating more steak is going to address the number one killer in America, which is heart disease? It just doesn't make any sense. And yet, here we are. So because it's so hard to reach people on the nutrition arguments because they just don't want to hear it, I think it would be helpful to have more people talking about what's in the meat.
And I just thought that was such an important dimension that you brought up that wasn't on my radar. once I thought about it, I was like, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But it's interesting because the Maha movement is about this idea of eating real food and the idea of returning to this more wholesome type of food that we used to eat in the past versus this really industrial, heavily processed food. But I think there's a pattern of meat getting ignored in terms of taking a closer look. It's always just assumed that one type of meat is the same as any other and that they're all the same and that it's all just what our cave people ancestors used to eat. But that's not really true. It's not true when it comes to the level of processing, where sometimes people will present the idea that a veggie burger is highly processed food and then something that you eat at McDonald's is not heavily processed. And that seems to be ignoring a big part of the story. And then what you bring out is similar to that, where there's all this attention being paid to certain chemicals and toxic chemicals in our foods. And yet this idea slips by that maybe we should be paying close attention to make sure it's not in the foods that we're promoting as being the top of the food pyramid. So do you have any thoughts on why that is, that meat just slips by the radar of people who are concerned about processing or people who are concerned about toxic chemicals?
I do think that to some extent it's ignorance. I think they don't know because our government doesn't tell them. So one of the things that we were hoping to see in the dietary guidelines was a discussion about how food is produced actually matters for environmental health. And so that was not in there. And there's no mention about the differences between, say, organic food, which is produced without pesticides, and then regular food, which is produced with huge amounts of pesticides. And interestingly, a study came out. It was a Chinese study, but it was the most comprehensive study that I've seen about what the pesticide exposures are. And 60% of the exposures that we're getting in our food are coming from animal foods. And they have the most toxic pesticides, like 2,4-D is very common, whereas the fruits and vegetables, less toxic pesticides, and it's a smaller percentage of our exposure. We can't ignore the fact that the meat and dairy industry has had a huge influence over all of these discussions. And so they've been behind a lot of the propaganda about the highly processed nature of plant-based food versus the wholesome nature of meat. They've been spinning it and people want to believe it. And that's been a big part of it. And we know that these guidelines, the scientific consensus that came out from the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, which were 20 independent experts, they all came out with a consensus based on a long, lengthy review of the data that encouraged and recommended plant-forward patterns like Mediterranean dash diet, legumes, nuts, seeds, soy as key proteins, and less red meat and less dairy based on the evidence, because we know that high quantities of red meat are associated with cancer. The evidence is absolutely overwhelming with meta studies across many different places, different countries. It's undeniable. And so when you follow the science, it leads you to promote less red meat and less full fat dairy. But when you follow the industry, then you get a whole different recommendation. And it was interesting that they basically threw out at least 50% of the recommendations of this scientific committee and then put a group of other folks in charge of writing this. And they did it very quickly. Many of the folks who were part of that group had financial ties to food companies with interest. I think four of them had relationships with the beef, pork, and dairy trade associations. Clearly, these dietary guidelines were in service to the big meat and dairy industry. And it's just so obvious. And for them to call that gold science when it's written in 90 days and throwing out 2 to 3 years of scientific review is just not credible.
In some ways, it speaks to a couple different things that are aggravating. On the one hand, there's the group that kind of comes in and changes all the norms and throws out the recommendations of the scientific committee in a way that doesn't usually happen with the dietary guidelines. But then there's also the flip side of that, which as the 2024 election was coming up, I was just thinking, please hurry up with the guidelines and let's just get it out. We know what's going to happen if there's a new administration coming in to do this. I don't blame them for following the process the way it's supposed to be followed.
Just one point, though, about previous administrations have always followed the guidelines, the guidance of the Scientific Advisory Committee.
Yeah.
It's interesting because 10 years ago, Friends of the Earth led a coalition to try to convince the USDA to address the environmental and health issues and to take environmental factors into account when recommending food, because we can't separate what you eat from the effects on the environment. And actually, the Dietary Guidelines Committee came up with recommendations to incorporate sustainability factors, which many countries around the world do that. And Secretary Vilsack from your great state of Iowa rejected that flat out. But just to say, they did follow the nutritional guidance from this committee. So they didn't follow the sustainability guidance, but they did follow the nutritional guidance. And I actually thought initially when Secretary Kennedy came in that he would take a more progressive view because he understands the links between environmental health and food. And actually, many folks who are leaders in the Maha community, you know, who I've talked with, they're not supportive of factory farming, industrial livestock. They're supportive of pasture-based, healthier, more organic animal products. They're definitely pro-meat, but they're pro-better meat. And I think that's something that we can share in common, but they're not holding their policymakers to account on this one because 97% of all the meat that is consumed in this country comes from factory farms, from the industrial system where they pump the animals with the antibiotics and pesticides and all the rest. I think they've approved over 400 drugs for animals. So you can't be promoting heavy meat diets without changing the policies in the agricultural system if you want to make it healthier for people. So anyway, I haven't seen much outrage from that community about this, but I do think they should be trying to hold Kennedy and others accountable for not addressing all of these very serious environmental health issues in the dietary guidelines.
As you're referencing, the Maha movement spans the political spectrum to some extent. It was not only conservative people, but also a lot of liberal people were supportive of that movement because of Secretary Kennedy. And it seems like they understand the difference between pasture-raised and organic animal agriculture versus factory farming. So it is really unfortunate that issue wasn't addressed and there hasn't been much pushback from that side on it. So one question I have for you is, how much success have you had either with the op-ed or just in general in terms of connecting with that Maha movement and being able to talk through some of these important points and point out the toxic mix of chemicals that are connected to animal agriculture and why that should be more of a priority?
It's a good question. I think we're just getting started. We want to do a lot more education on this issue, just what's in your meat, particularly looking at school food, understanding better what is not in the meat that the kids are consuming, because the kids are the most susceptible with their growing bodies to these harmful chemicals. And I think there is openness and interest, and certainly several of the leaders in Maha are all about regenerative agriculture, whether they're conservative, Republican, or libertarian, or wherever they come from politically. We all share in the desire to take back our food system from corporate control. They support local control and raising animals in ways that are more humane, primarily on pasture, organic feed. So I don't see that there's a disagreement about that. And some of them are promoting regenerative agriculture with the USDA. They were upset about cutting back the local food for school programs and have been advocating on that somewhat. But the question is, what are they willing to do about the fact that there's mostly been a lot of embracing of these guidelines in general by the movement? There's a distinction around Maha, I would say, between the political arm of Maha, which is Maha Action, and they pretty much just support everything that Kennedy does and support everything that the administration does to some extent, with the exception of pesticide, the preemption issue. But they're really there to just promote what Kennedy is doing. So they're not going to be criticizing anything that comes out of his administration. But I do think that there's openness. We have to keep educating. And one of the goals that we have at Friends of the Earth is to get federal procurement dollars. So the money that's being spent by the USDA and by HHS and by the military, to get more of those dollars to go to independent producers, organic producers that don't use routine antibiotics or growth promoting drugs, so that there's more of values-based procurement in those systems. And right now, I think the USDA spends about $4.8 billion on food. 5% of that goes to Tyson. Half of it goes to animal products. We know that most of those animal products are coming from these industrial systems, big corporations. And I think that MAHA is aligned. They'd like to see a shift in procurement. I have talked to them about that issue. They want to see a shift in procurement. And we've reached out to Secretary Kennedy with a bunch of groups across the political spectrum, urging him to be a leader on that and shift some of the procurement. HHS as well. There's going to be more work focused on the military. There's opportunity here if we can get them to focus on this, and that's where we need to focus. There's an Effective Procurement Act. I don't know if you're familiar with that piece of legislation that Friends of the Earth has been advocating for. It was introduced back, I think, in December, and that also that instructs USDA to shift some of its procurement towards independent, sustainable producers.
Some good reason for hope. I appreciate that. You touched on this already, but once the dietary guidelines came out, was there anything else you wanted to add about how you felt about it?
Really, I would just reiterate that eating more steak and cheese will not fix our chronic disease crisis. I find it so hard to believe that we can say that with a straight face. And I don't know if you saw the picture of Kennedy with his steak and his three candles that HHS put out to say steak, not cake. And it's like eating steak is part of what is causing the heart disease is the number one killer in America. And overconsumption of red meat is a big part of that. It really contradicts the evidence, and it's just not science-based. So I think that's really important to say. It's not going to fix chronic disease. All the recommendations around whole foods and less processed foods and less sugar, that's all great. And that really was in the other guidelines as well. It just wasn't as clearly stated, not processed food. But the thing to say is that study after study, including the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee report, talk about the fact that the foods that are strongly linked to better health are beans, lentils, peas, and soy, whole grains, fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds. These are the whole foods that we should be eating more of. And I would add to that, please make them organic when you can, because some of these foods also do have heavy metals and other pesticides. So please make them organic when you can. And then the evidence shows that if you consume more of these fiber-rich foods, and we're only getting less than 10% of the fiber we need. So eating more of these fiber-rich foods are linked to lower heart disease and cancer risk, healthier weight, and longer life. So if you want to live longer and have a healthier weight and lower your cancer and your heart disease risk, it's eat more plants. It's not eat more meat. So that's the message we want to convey. And it's important not just because it matters for individuals, because honestly, most people don't follow the dietary guidelines. They never have. If people followed the dietary guidelines for the last 15, 20 years, we would not have the levels of obesity and heart disease and cancer that we have in this country. But why it matters so much is that these guidelines are influential in defining how the U.S. government spends its food dollars, school meals, and other feeding programs, the military. The guidelines are very influential over how the U.S. spends its food dollars. So very important for that reason. And I think we just have to keep an eye on how this changes their expenditures. There's a lot more we could talk about with the doubling the protein recommendations. It's interesting because they doubled the protein recommendations and put meat at the top of the pyramid, but they also said keep your saturated fat limit to 10%. Right. That means that people need to get their protein from plants. If you believe that we all need more protein, which the data show that people are generally getting more protein than they need, but there's certain groups for whom more protein is good. If you're an athlete or some older people need more protein, if you want to follow the dietary guidelines on the saturated fat limits, then you need to be eating more plants. So that's basically more plant-based sources of protein. So it's interesting because they give you the pyramid, but actually, if you read the guidelines, if you want to follow the true guidelines on the 10% sat fat limit, then yeah, you'll end up eating more plants. So really, we should have the beans and the lentils at the top of the pyramid.
I remember seeing that inconsistency. Keeping the saturated fat recommendations was interesting in relation to everything else. The other point that you made that I wanted to highlight is fiber should be more of a priority. There's this huge podcast movement right now talking about protein, and fiber seems to be the thing that we know from good science that people are not getting enough of. Big fiber needs to start stepping up their game. That all is really informative and also makes a lot of sense in relation to Friends of the Earth's overall project. I was wondering if you could say just a little bit more about your view on the food system. And some of this came out when you were describing some of the programs you work on. What are the biggest things that you think need to change about the food system in the United States in order to have healthier people and a more sustainable environment?
Thanks for that question. If I could take the power back from big agribusiness, agrochemical companies, and big meat and dairy, because those are the two that are controlling our policy right now in Washington and both at the EPA and USDA and Congress. So if I could wave a magic wand to make our food system better, there's probably two primary things. One is to shift the subsidies away from industrial agriculture and monoculture, all the feed crops that go into animals and biofuels. So primarily all the subsidies. And the big, beautiful, ugly bill actually increased by $60 billion subsidies for those crops that are grown for animals and for biofuels, not for people, not healthy food for people. And they're very heavily pesticide intensive, GMOs, et cetera. So shifting the subsidies towards healthy foods, including more funding for scratch cooking in schools and changing the way that we produce school meals is one piece of it. But the second piece of it, which is probably even a more important piece for public health, would be to implement stronger oversight and regulation of industrial animal agriculture and industrial agriculture writ large at the EPA, which pretty much gives a pass to industrial agriculture writ large. And because industrial agriculture and particularly animal agriculture is so poorly regulated, it causes a lot of health issues. I think 13,000 deaths are attributed to industrial animal agriculture from primarily air pollution. But there's a lot of externalities or costs that society bears from the industrial agriculture system, which should be internalized by greater oversight and regulation. And we've done a lot of surveys of voters across the political spectrum. And it doesn't matter if you're a MAGA voter or a liberal voter, everybody wants more oversight and regulation of the food system to protect people. They want clean air, clean water. This is not a right-left issue for the population. It is a Democrat-Republican issue in Congress because big ag and big food have more capture over the Republicans. They have a lot of capture over the Democrats, too. There's a lot of folks in the Democratic Party that are also not willing to do the kind of regulation and oversight that's needed of our industrial food system. But I would say those two things. So let's shift the funding to the right kinds of foods and let's protect people's public health by much stricter oversight and banning all the pesticides and the animal drugs that are banned in other countries. These should be banned. The data that we have, we just did some surveying. 89% of Americans believe that we should ban pesticides that are banned in other countries. That probably goes to the animal drugs as well, like ractopamine, which is banned in 160 countries. It's a growth promoter for pork and beef, and we use it rampantly in the U.S. So things like that would make a big difference. But until we get the corporate influence out of politics, it's a tough road. So in the end, we need more consumers speaking out with their dollars in the marketplace and also asking more of their leaders to stand up to big ag and the big agrochemical companies and big meat and dairy. And we need the politicians to get a spine when it comes to that.
Along those lines, what would you suggest for people who are listening who would like to help out with Friends of the Earth's efforts?
I would say go to our website, foe.org, F-O-E.org, and sign up for alerts so you can be informed of the campaigns that we have going where we are looking for people to sign letters and make phone calls. We're going to be needing a lot of that going on. There's going to be a farm bill markup coming up this year, and there's going to be a lot of opportunity to make calls. Right now, the Republicans are pushing a pesticide immunity bill that would essentially restrict, you could not hold pesticide companies accountable for poisoning people with their pesticides. And that's something the Republicans are pushing. And I think the Democrats are standing up firm against that. So I think we just have to keep calling the Republicans and telling them to take that provision out of the farm bill. But there's a lot of things in the farm bill that are going to dictate where your money, where tax dollars go. So pay a lot of attention to that. There's a lot of other great groups working on this issue to follow and to support with action alerts and phone calls. And I just think that wherever you are, one thing about food compared to other industries is that we eat three meals a day. And so we always have an opportunity to put our values where we put our fork, and we can always support better agriculture through what we eat. We need to vote with our votes and vote with our dollars, asking your supermarkets to carry more local and organic, asking your school districts to serve more local, organic, plant-forward food, restaurants, wherever you shop, wherever you eat, to keep raising these issues so that there's more incentives in the system to shift what's purchased. That's important. And to keep raising awareness with all your friends and family about what's in animal products. It's not just meat. We've been focusing a lot on meat, but actually there's a lot of chemicals in the dairy foods as well, particularly traces of antibiotics. The USDA actually does testing of these products. You can learn a little bit more through that. So those are some things. It's important to get people to be paying more attention to the chemical contaminants in their animal products. I personally have been working on these issues for more than a decade, really 15 years. When I was at the Environmental Working Group, I did something called the Meat Eater's Guide to Climate Change and Health. And a lot of these issues we were talking about 15 years ago, it's very discouraging to me that we're living now in a time when meat is so revered, and especially on social media. And it's just, it seems like people are just not paying attention to the real science and to what the harm that it's doing both to our bodies, to the planet, to the animals. So I'm hoping that there can be more attention on this, more focus on that, and more funding from the philanthropic community to focus on these issues.
It's been wonderful to talk to you, and I was so glad that Op-Ed came out and made some really excellent points, and I will share the link to that on the podcast episode so everyone can read it, because I think it's really well argued. Thank you so much for joining me, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Adam. Appreciate it very much.
That's it for this week's episode of Canary in a Cornfield. Just a reminder, you can find the Harkin Institute on social media, which includes X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and find our webpage at harkininstitute@drake.edu. And this podcast is also hosted by Substack Canary in a Cornfield, which will include some additional links and resources that go beyond just what's in the episode. So thank you all for tuning in, and I will be talking with you soon.